In its quest to provide an open forum for discussion of controversial issues, this station allows hosts and their guests to express themselves without any significant censorship. You're advised that any views expressed by the hosts or their guests are not necessarily the views of Tugi Entertainment or its partners.
The Mary Beth Wells Hour is a talk radio show where we reach out, reach deep, and talk about topics of substance. We'll cover points of interest, such as World War II and the Holocaust, the Vietnam War, the planets and the oceans, skydiving, rock climbing, and much, much more. Join me every Monday at 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time as we delve into and discuss fascinating subjects. It's a program to pique your interest for sure.
And good morning and welcome back to the Mary Beth Wells Hour on TogiNet Radio. Listeners, if you have questions, please feel free to call in on our toll-free number, 877-864-4869. Today, my show focus is on the combat engineer regiments who bravely fought against the Axis powers from North Africa into Sicily, Italy, France, Central Europe, and ended their tour of duty in Germany in 1945. My guest has painstakingly researched materials and dedicated her website to her father and the men that served with him. I welcome Miriam Shard. Hi, Miriam.
Good morning, Mary Beth. How are you?
I'm wonderful. It's lovely to have you on the show this morning.
Well, thank you for the wonderful opportunity. I'm so happy to be able to discuss my father and his fellow combat engineers.
Great. Marianne, I'd like for you to start by giving us your website. Tell us what led you to start it and your box of chocolates.
Okay. The website is Six Corps Combat Engineers, and what led me to start it was my father. He passed away when I was 12 and a half, very young, and he was always one of those veterans. You either get the kind that don't talk or the kind that do. Well, my dad did talk about the war, and it left an indelible impression on me as a young child. When he passed away, I had this box of chocolates. It was a old box from Chicago, and in that box were his pins and patches, some photographs, different items from the war. And I always treasured it. No matter what point in my life, it always stayed next to my bed. And every few years, every few months, you know, I'd always open it up and my mind would start wandering, and I'd think, you know, who are the guys in the pictures, and what do all these things mean? Where did he go? Because as a young child, even though you have a good sense, you forget all the details.
Of course you do.
Anyway,
yes.
As life went on, I was more and more curious, and I thought, you know, I wish I could get some answers. Well, finally, when we moved up north about 9.5 years ago from Detroit, it was in the dead of winter, and I'm sitting here in front of my computer, and I thought, you know, I've got the internet at my disposal. Well, long story short, I started doing some research, typing in some things that I found in the box, and eventually putting the pieces back together again. Mm-hmm. That led to me discovering certain World War II vets. In fact, I found a World War II vet that was in my father's unit. Well, you can imagine my thrill after
Absolutely.
All these years.
Oh, my goodness, to connect with somebody that actually was in the same unit as your dad and knew him.
Yes. It was just, it was exciting beyond all belief. When I got the letter in the mail, I think I read it about 10 times, and I showed my husband, and he said, oh, my God. I said, this is like manna from heaven. Well, from there, everything just kind of snowballed. Eventually, he led me to another vet who led me to another vet, and so on and so on. And pretty soon, I was starting to amass quite a bit of information. Well, that led me, I thought, you know, I should share this with everyone. So I started a web page. It started out as one simple web page. Basically, this was my father's unit. You know, they went to North Africa, Sicily, Italy, and so on. And from there, here we are 7-8 years later, and every time I look at my webpage, I'm still astounded at all the information that was, you know, sent my way. It wound up being a real treasure trove.
How many people follow you or come out to your page?
Oh, well, every week, according to all the stats, there's several hundred people that visit on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. I also have a forum, and right now we have 963 members on the main site as of this morning. We have 164,672 visitors since June 24th, 2004.
That's pretty impressive. Marianne, I know that this is a question you are asked often. Who were the combat engineers?
Well, that was something that amazed me as I went along. As I started learning more and more, I'll tell you, I was astounded by all the things that these men did. They were responsible for so much during the war. They did things such as bridge building. They did port and harbor rehabilitation. They laid roads for vehicles. They unloaded and loaded supplies. They provided water supply and sanitation, not only for the troops, but for also local people in the area. They did map production, maintenance of vehicles, forestry. They built barracks, depots, all kinds of structures. They, of course, they did mine clearing, mine detonation. They cleared beaches of obstacles. There's just so many things that they were responsible for. Also, there are there were a lot of different kinds of combat or engineers. There's firefighting platoons, airborne aviation battalions, general service regiments, and, of course, combat engineers, which my father was. And there's probably several different kinds. And like I said, they were so instrumental in the war. Without combat engineers, the Army simply just wouldn't move.
You know, these are things that don't often come to a person's mind. It's like almost behind the scenes, but they are in the forefront. It's an oxymoron type of thing that, you know, here they were responsible for all these things. It's things that you just don't think about when you think of World War II and the soldiers fighting. So it's so interesting to hear that all this was done by these wonderful men, the engineer regiments.
Yeah, you nailed it on the head. A lot of these things are totally behind the scenes, and you're right. I didn't even think about it when I began my research. A lot of it came to me as a surprise, and like I said, they certainly have won my support, and they're just a wonderful group of men. Like I said, you always think about infantry units. You think about tank battalions. You think about airborne units. But very few people, even the World War II vets, a lot of them came to me and said, wow, I didn't realize, you know, all this went on behind the scenes.
No, and it's really incredible to me that these men actually kept the war running. You think about building barracks and, the roads that were so necessary. I mean, they were getting bombed all the time. And
right.
Setup and sanitation and the maintenance of vehicles. It's incredible.
It certainly is incredible. We could just spend a whole hour just talking about, you know, those specific things without even touching on anything else.
Okay, the engineers rolling in amphibious warfare was not considered until shortly before the attack on Pearl Harbor in December of 1941. How was that changed?
Well, As with any kind of warfare, tactics are always evolving. What worked well in one war doesn't necessarily fare well in the next due to changes in weapons and other things. They certainly discovered this during the Civil War while they were still embracing Napoleonic techniques. And this was certainly true during World War II. Armies have to move across vast expanses of water, and they have to seize beachheads. It became apparent that the Axis controlled almost every major port in Europe, so new strategies had to be developed. By mid-41, the Corps of Engineers embarked on an aggressive program to revise its military units and equipment. Mary Beth, it was a whole new ball game.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I find it quite interesting that this came into play and that it was implemented just before the attack on Pearl Harbor.
Yes, just before. It's amazing how much they actually, you know, pulled together. They pulled together so quickly, and it was like on the spur of the moment. They had to work with this and work with this, and every time they tried something new, something else would come up, and they always were continuously implementing new ideas and new strategies. So they really had to think on their feet.
I'm sure that they did. Go ahead.
I was going to say the engineers are good for that. Like I said, they think on their feet. They're always trying new things. They have to be innovative at, you know, every moment of the day and night.
We were on the brink of war. I mean, the very brink of war when this new plan came for the combat engineers to become involved in. The amphibious warfare, and how much did they have to restructure what they had originally gone into?
Well, as you see, they back before World War II, you know, they were still thinking in World War I terms. It's okay. Just like any other war. Like I said, during the Civil War, they were still thinking back with Napoleonic, you know, ideas and terms and using techniques. Like all of a sudden, look at Hitler back in 1939 with a blitzkrieg.
We're going to go to a quick break. Hold that thought on Hitler.
Okay.
And we'll cover that when we get back.
How to invest, where to invest, where to save, where to get the right insurance, what to do about taxes, should I relocate my business or ever purchase a property? That's where Go To My Radio Show comes in. Join host Chris Holt Tuesday afternoons at 1 Pacific, 3 Central on GoToMyRadioShow.com. Choose the right financial professional and learn more about the products and services while learning the terminology and strategies used by these professionals. Go To My Radio Show is unbiased, and Chris Holt, your host, will ask the hard questions and take calls to help you connect with the right professional who can help you better handle your financial and business choices. Go To My Radio Show is not a financial services company and does not offer any financial advice, but we will help you make the right choice when it comes to planning your financial future, and most of all, choosing the right program and the right professional for you. Go To My Radio Show with Chris Holt Tuesday afternoons at 1 Pacific, 3 Central on GoToMyRadioShow.com.
Okay, we will. We're going to teach you how to tell your money where to go. It's Intelligent Investing with Pam Otten on TogiNet. Learn how to be a savvy investor from someone who has your best interest at heart. Pam Otten is a financial advisor who loves to help successful business owners and entrepreneurs understand the mysteries of the investment world. And she's not afraid to share that knowledge. Pam is an unashamed Christian and qualified kingdom advisor, which means she's trained and committed to integrating biblical principles into her financial advice. Pam believes investing isn't rocket science. This is the financial advisor who's in your corner and truly understands and cares about you and helping you achieve your goals. Securities and advisory services are offered through LPL Financial, member FINRA SIPC. It's Intelligent Investing with Pam Otten on TogiNet.
my guest, Marion Shard. Marion, before we went to break, we were talking about the engineer's new role in amphibious warfare and that they were basically thrown into this. So to be prepared was, it was an amazing feat, I think. You were telling us something about Hitler right before we broke.
The Hitler's new tactics, all of a sudden, with the invasion of Poland and the invasion of other countries, he was using what they called blitzkrieg tactics. And all of a sudden, you're facing tanks of great proportion. You're getting bombardment. Everything moves so quickly. And all of a sudden, we had to respond to that. Luckily, for America, what really was a big key point was our industrial complex, that all of a sudden we had all these men and women who we could put to work and we could implement new ideas. And that, like I said, that was a strategic point for us. We had to think on our feet. The combat engineers were put up against tactics that they had never seen before. When we went over to North Africa in 1942, we were pretty darn green. And a lot of the things that we tried, some things worked, some things didn't work. It was constantly being revised as we went along. We made a lot of mistakes in the beginning. It couldn't be helped, but
absolutely,
we learned quickly from our mistakes.
Okay. Your father's unit crossed the Rhine on March 26, 1945. What kind of detailed information do you have on this?
Well, actually, it's amazing. I have a whole file cabinet, and it's probably filled with about 2,500 pages of information from the war. I have daily, weekly, and monthly reports from that time period, a wealth of information from the National Archives. After perusing page after page, you see all the work and preparation that goes into, like, just a single river crossing. The logistics are mind-boggling. On March 26, 1945, towards the end of the war, the 540th, along with their attached and supporting units, including the 85th Heavy Ponton Battalion, they completed a Class 40 reinforced ponton bridge. The bridge was over 1,000 feet in length, and they named it after General Alexander Patch. The construction for this bridge began at 0600 hours, and it took them about 9 hours and 15 minutes. And the completion of this bridge actually allowed the 3rd Infantry Division to march into Germany. During those first 24 hours, over 3,000 vehicles crossed over its decking.
Amazing. Truly amazing. Tell us about the many crossings of the Rhine that month. And what were the engineers up against?
Well, look at it this way. Use your imagination and think. It's tough enough just wrecking a regular bridge under good circumstances. But here, during this part of the war, it's late winter, early spring in Germany. And the entire American army is trying like hell to reach Hitler at various points all along the length of the Rhine. The Rhine River is a large, deep, cold, and swiftly moving body of water. And the enemy is lobbing shells and trying to deter you with all their might. Most of the structures have been blown to pieces to thwart the Allies. So it was up to my dad and his fellow engineers to keep the armies moving, and that meant building various types of floating and fixed bridges. It was quite a feat, to say the least.
It's amazing that this could be accomplished while they were being fired on and the Germans were trying to stop them, and they were successful in crossing it.
Absolutely. Bridge building, I would have to say, of all the things the engineers did, is the most fascinating aspect to me. In fact, when I go to the reunions and see some of my engineer friends, and I look at my World War II vets, and I said, you know what I would really like to do if I ever had a chance? And they kind of look at me because they never know what to expect. And I said, I would really like to build a Bailey Bridge.
Well, Marianne, everyone is aware of the Normandy D-Day landings, but most are completely unaware of the invasion of southern France. Can you tell us about it and how the VI Corps' engineers played a vital role?
Oh, sure. That's a great question, Mary Beth. I can't tell you how many people I've run into over the last 6-7 years who are completely ignorant about Operation Dragoon. It gets very little attention, even in books and movies, and so I'm always trying to rectify that. Though it was like hotly contested, it was finally agreed that a secondary invasion would have to take place on August 15th, and this was several weeks after the Normandy invasion occurred. One thing I want you to notice is that I didn't call the Normandy invasion D-Day, for there were numerous D-Days which took place throughout the war, but we'll save that for a whole other discussion. Anyway, there were 851 ships which composed this invasion fleet. The majority of those were Americans, but there were also British, French, Greek, Dutch, Norwegian, Polish, Belgian, and even Italians involved in this invasion. The amphibious operation and the conquest of the beachhead were carried out by the Americans. And here's where three of the four main units of my research that come into play. That would be the 36th, the 48th, and my dad's unit, the 540th. The 39th at this time remained in Italy, and they were fighting northward after the fall of Rome. I would also like to note that the 1108th Engineer Combat Group, they were comprised of two engineer battalions, the 48th and the 235th. The 48th separated from that group while they were still in Italy, and they left the 235th behind. And then the 48th actually trained together with my father's unit in preparation for the invasion of southern France. These guys were all seasoned veterans, and they had previously fought in North Africa in 42 and 43, in Sicily in 1943, and in Italy for 43 and 44. In Italy, they were involved in the campaigns of Salerno, Naples, Anzio, and also Rome. The 540th and the 48th engineers landed at Camel Sector with the 36th Infantry Division at Fréjus. The 45th Infantry, they held the middle ground at Delta Sector, and the 36th engineers landed with the 3rd Infantry Division at Cavalier-sur-Mer, and they made up Alpha Sector.
What were their 1.2. assignments?
Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just wondering, what were their assignments?
Well, actually, they were in charge of so many things. They had to do mine sweeps. They had to clear beach obstacles. Played a pivotal role in unloading vehicles, gas, rations.
They conducted what we talked about earlier.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Most of the bridges had been destroyed, and the Germans wanted that to be the case with the Ludendorff Bridge. What happened?
Colonel Peregrin's 291st Engineer Combat Battalion were resuming their advance into Germany in early March of 45. There were rumors around about the last remaining bridge at Remagen. And yes, this is the same famous bridge that is portrayed in the movie that many of us have seen. On March 7th, the Germans tried to blow the Ludendorff Bridge to halt the spearhead of the 9th Armored Division. Much to the dismay of the Germans, their attempts failed more than once, due in part to the 291st engineers successfully severing detonation wires. And the bridge actually remained standing, though it was very badly damaged.
Okay. All right. Very interesting. On the evening of March 8th, how many American troops crossed that bridge?
Well, it was an astounding number. There were actually over 8,000 American soldiers who crossed it. But actually in doing so, too, because of all the weight and the vehicles and everything going across, it also led to a weakening of the bridge even more. But in the meantime, the 291st attempted to repair it to the best of their ability, and they also began constructing a tactical bridge. It was actually a treadway bridge just down from the damaged one. The treadway bridge wound up being 1,032 feet in length, and this one took 32 hours to complete. The actual Ludendorff bridge, the one which was blown, and it finally collapsed on March 17th, and approximately 30 engineers lost their lives, and dozens were injured. It was a very, very sad day for the 291st.
I'm sure that it was. I mean, wasn't this about the only bridge that was left standing?
Oh, that is correct. The Germans did one hell of a job blowing bridges, and they tried everything they could to thwart the attack across the Rhine, because they knew once the Americans and the British and everyone came across that river, they were pretty much done for.
Right, because they were being pushed further and further into that corner of no return.
So, that's correct.
I mean, thanks to these combat engineers, had it not been for them, and the rebuilding of this bridge, all those American troops and other troops that followed would not have made it across.
You're absolutely right. The war pretty much would have come to a grinding halt.
Yeah.
So here, once again, talking about the Rhine River, you see the important role engineers of every type played in the war.
We're going to go to a break. We'll be right back. Stay tuned.
Everyday Autism Miracles with Shannon Pinrod. Friday afternoons at 2, 1 Central on TogiNet.com. Life after an autism spectrum diagnosis doesn't have to be difficult. It can be joyful, happy, and filled with hope. Join Shannon Pinrod, author, speaker, coach, and mom of a six-year-old recovering from autism, for this inspirational hour of hope. She's even authored a series of children's autism books with her son, Jim. For more information about the books, Shannon, and Everyday Autism Miracles, go to her website, shannonpinrod.com. From there, you can also get to her other websites, blogs, and connections. On Everyday Autism Miracles, you'll hear stories from parents whose children have made miraculous strides. You'll also get the inside dish on therapies, treatments, supplements, and how to get funding to help you afford them. Miracles abound in the autism community. So tune in for Everyday Autism Miracles to listen, share, laugh, and surround yourself with hope. Everyday Autism Miracles with Shannon Pinrod. Friday afternoons at 2, 1 Central on TogiNet.com. Is there more living for you to do? Yes. Start living inspired. Be here for Living Inspired with Tricia Goyer. Thursday afternoons at 4, 3 p.m. Central on TogiNet.com. Tricia will dig deep into topics that matter most to women, inspiring women to make a change in their own lives and to make a difference in the world, and maybe even deep within their own hearts. Tricia is a wife, mom, speaker, family expert, and author of 24 books. For more information on Tricia and Living Inspired, go to her website, TriciaGoyer.com. That's TriciaGoyer.com. Trisha's vision is to be the voice of hope and possibility for women of all ages. Her intention is to serve ordinary women by encouraging extraordinary things with God's help. Trisha expresses real life, real hope for real women. Is there more living for you to do? Yes. Start living inspired. Living Inspired with Tricia Goyer. Thursday afternoons at 4, 3 p.m. Central on TogiNet.com.
Okay, we are back for the second half of our show with my guest, Marion Shard. Marion, when the American troops crossed the Ludendorff Bridge, the battalion was awarded the Presidential Union Citation. Was that the 291st Division?
Yes, it was. The 291st Engineer Battalion, yes.
Okay, so...
I can tell you some of their accomplishments, because actually when they came into the war during the Normandy invasion, they were a pretty a green unit, and their accomplishments were very impressive. The 291st wound up building 23 timber, 44 bailey, 7 treadway bridges, and 11 of those were built under fire. They also destroyed 6 bridges. They made 7 assault crossings. They deactivated 15 bombs, cleared over 7,000 mines, and wound up capturing 8,500 German prisoners. Amazing. That's another thing that you wouldn't think of that combat engineers would do, but they were actually that actually was very common, and they wound up building POW camps, too, for the German prisoners, which they caught.
It's truly amazing everything that they did in this war. It just continues to go on and on.
On and on, yes. Every little piece of information, and you go, wow.
I know. You know what, Marion? You have not given us your website. I want you to do that right now before we get to the end of the program and we don't have it. What is it so that people can go out and view it?
Sure. It's www.6 Corps Combat Engineers.
Corps. Six spelled out, or is it the number?
It's the number 6, T-H, then Corps, C-O-R-P-S,
CombatEngineers.com. CombatEngineers.com, and I will put that on my website, too. That's so
thank you.
Can find it, absolutely. Your website has so many interesting stories and articles. And I found the engineer branch history submitted by Dr. David Albrecht to be particularly interesting. I love the quotation, engineers, those who served the engines of war. It's a history of war, very well done. Tell us a bit about that.
Sure. Actually, I got to meet Dr. David Albrecht earlier this year. I was invited down to Fort Leonard Wood. I got to spend several days down there. I had a wonderful time, and David was a wonderful host. I got to sit on a panel. I was also interviewed down there, and David is just a wealth of information. The article that you found on my website, I think it gives a really good feel for the scope of the work the engineers have accomplished throughout history, not just our American history. The engines of war actually refer to weapons such as catapults and ballista, which were used against stone fortifications such as castles. Just when they thought they were safe behind castle walls, you know, engineers always came up with clever ways to breach those. It's one of those, another thing that every time something comes up, engineers goes, wait, we can get across this or we can get through this. David's article also covers the important role of civil engineering throughout history. If you take a look, like at the taming of the Mississippi River or the building of the Panama Canal, these are just a few of the very good examples of what engineers can do during war and during peacetime.
Yes, I thought it was extremely interesting, and the graphics to it too of it too were. As I said, it was very well done, David. And he was a guest on my show, too. So,
I got to hear it. And that was a great interview with him.
Good. Thank you. The engineers had been developing the tank dozer concept. What was that, Marion, and how was it implemented?
Well, the idea actually began flourishing in early 1940, and they actually tested a successful model around 1943. If you took a Sherman tank, you could actually it would actually become a tank dozer. What you would have to do is add a standard M1 bulldozer blade and a hydraulic jack, which would raise and lower it. The tank dozer excelled at clearing beach obstacles and dangerous mines. It really provided a means for combat engineers to repair roads while they were under fire. In fact, we were talking about the Remagen Bridge and the 291st, and I can give you a fine example of this.
Please.
That hole that was blown into the bridge, the 291st actually took tank dozers and began filling that large hole that was left by the Germans' attempt to blow the bridge. In Italy and Sicily and various places, in fact, in Italy, ordnance troops of the 6th Corps actually devised their own tank dozer, and they used it for firefighting duty while attempting to put out burning ammo dumps and different things like that. Once again, I say the engineers are very innovative. I'm not sure if you're familiar with their motto, SANs.
No. Please
well,
share that with us.
That goes way back, and SANs actually means let's try. And it's very simple, but very true. You know, like I said, as soon as they come up with an obstacle, they go, okay, let's try, let's see what we do, and they always come up with something great.
These guys were positive. They were the glass half full, not half
yes,
empty.
Yes, half full. The glass is never half empty to an engineer. There's nothing they can't conquer.
And you would have to be in this particular core branch and devise all these things that they have done and move through the obstacles as they did. Yeah, so, well, that's very interesting about the tank dozer. You have an article written by Ernie Pyle entitled Mapping and Engineering the War. He wrote while in Sicily. You may never have seen it mentioned, but a map is as common a piece of equipment among frontline officers as a steel helmet. Would you please expound on that for us?
Oh, sure. Ernie's one of my favorite World War II writers, and I just love reading all his work. And in this particular article, he mentions the immensity of the MAP program would amaze you. When it came from America, the 45th Division brought with it 83 tons of Sicilian maps. Now think about that. 83 tons of maps. That just blows your mind on any
yes.
scale. Basically, at that point, they had been working with very old Italian maps. And in other words, they were out of date. However, with reconnaissance planes, they could take new photographs all the time. Accurate maps could be implemented. And they actually took the new maps and superimposed them over the old. This kept the process of correction open to the very last minute. What I can say is an army is basically as good as its maps. You get an inaccurate map, it could have devastating effects, as you can well imagine.
Okay.
And by the way, I have to say, Ernie had the utmost respect for engineers, and he always spoke very highly of them.
Okay, go ahead. Good. Well, he knew that the maps were needed for the men to move forward.
Absolutely. If you got you can imagine getting a wrong map and going out on patrol, taking a wrong turn, or realizing that something that used to be there is not there anymore. Maybe it's stone buildings that are no longer there. Any little thing could throw you off. You take a wrong turn, you go the wrong way, and you know, a lot of times these men are out there marching during the night and during snowstorms and during all kinds of conditions. So having a very, very accurate map is just critical to any kind of operation during the war.
Yeah, critical to say the least. Tell us about the engineers, Anzio, and the Battle of the Bulge.
Wow. Now, this would be a whole topic unto itself, but I'll try and be as concise as I can.
Okay.
Basically, Anzio was a real hellhole, and many of the men often referred to it as Death's Head. Those words, I should say Anzio, that word actually was ingrained into my head from the time I was a very young child. In the beginning of the interview, I related how my dad was willing to and very eager to tell his stories from the war. So when I heard Anzio, it, you know, it brings back just a flood of memories.
It rings a bell, yes.
The actual campaign began in January of 44 and lasted until May. That's 4 months of trying to gain ground and being pinned down by the Germans who held the higher ground. My father, in fact, sustained his wounds there during the breakout to Rome on May 24th. He was acting as a motorcycle courier, and he was hit by a mortar shell and sent to the 15th EVAC hospital. I don't really have any more information specifically on that. That's kind of stuff that I actually gleaned from a prior friend of his, and then also I found an event that was listed in the National Archives documentation that I received. My dad would always tell me about how they were forced to build machine shops and everything underground. And also, Sixth Corps also had their headquarters unit underground. This enabled them to keep working in spite of all the shelling and all the warfare that was going on around them. At Anzio, you have to understand that the shelling was incessant. It went on day and night.
Constant.
And it was almost impossible to maneuver during the daylight hours.
So not only did they have to go through all of this, the in being in fierce fighting conditions, but they had to build underground so that they could do their work. We're going to go to our final break. Marianne,
okay.
We will be right back.
Capture the simple peace of the Amish in your own life. Amish Wisdom with Suzanne Woods Fisher. Thursday afternoons at 5, 4 Central. Each week, Suzanne will have conversations with guests about living a life that incorporates principles of the Amish without going Amish. She'll cover the practical, simplicity, slowing down, reducing clutter, putting the brakes on materialism. The historical, how have the Amish survived for 400 years? How can we hold on to what we hold dear? And the spiritual, treasuring important values, honoring the past, and increasing peace of mind. You don't have to become Amish to make personal peace a reality. Amish Wisdom will help all of us live a simpler life. For more information, go to SuzanneWoodsFisher.com. With Amish Wisdom, Suzanne offers us a glimpse into a world of peace, serenity, and total commitment to family and God. This show just might change the way you live your life. It's Amish Wisdom with Suzanne Woods Fisher. Thursday afternoons at 5, 4 Central on TogiNet.com.
Do holidays and celebrations get you down and leave you feeling frazzled? Then join Sandy Fowler and her guests on Heartfilled Holidays every Monday at noon, 11 a.m. Central on TogiNet.com. Sandy will help you discover the secrets to having the celebrations you've always dreamed of while adding fun and meaning to your life. From Valentine's Day to Christmas to special family events, Sandy Fowler will show you how to put the fun and meaning back into those special days by taking a look at what we can do to turn the upcoming holidays into cherished memories and show us how to allow it to intertwine with everyday life. For more on the show, Sandy, and to receive Sandy's Holiday Happiness Booklet, go to HeartFilledHolidays.com. Then get set to discover the secrets to creating happy holidays and happy everydays by joining Sandy Fowler and her guests on Heartfilled Holidays every Monday at noon Eastern Standard Time on TogiNet.com.
And we are back for the final segment of our show today. Marion, we need to move on because there's a few other things that we need to cover, but this is a website. Marion's website is a place that you want to go and you want to read these articles. It is so interesting. The official records of the Corps housed at the Military Academy at West Point disappeared in a pre-Civil War fire in 1838 that destroyed the building containing the records. As a result, there are speculative stories about the origin of the engineers. Can you tell us some of these?
Oh, sure. A few tidbits here. George Washington was actually appointed the first engineer officers in June of 1775 during the American Revolution. And the engineers have served in combat in all subsequent American wars. The Army established the Corps of Engineers as a separate and permanent branch in March of 1802, and this gave the engineers responsibility for the founding and operating the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. From early on, the Corps of Engineers not only served during times of war, but as we talked about earlier, they functioned as civil engineers, and they worked on various projects, including the very important mapping of much of our country.
It's pretty incredible that this dates all the way back to George Washington.
Absolutely.
Yeah, amazing stories. Let's talk about your father. He was awarded two pins of honor. One is the CIB, which is the Combat Infantry Badge that is awarded to personnel with an infantry military occupational specialty who have satisfactorily performed duty under fire. And the Expert Sniper Badge, which is awarded to Brotherhood soldiers who get 1,000 kills in matched combat. How much of this did you have knowledge of, or did you find this out through your research?
Most of it was through my research. When I talked about the box of chocolates, those were two of the items which were in that little box. When I was younger, I really didn't know the meaning of most of all the what it contained. When I found out about the Expert Sniper Badge, it didn't really surprise me because I remember my dad being a great shot when I was young. It wasn't until I got married to my husband, Lee, and he was looking through the things. He said, hey, that's a CIB. And he said, he stated to me how much it meant to a soldier and, you know, and how they earned it. It really wasn't until I began my research and found out how controversial it was for a combat engineer to actually have one. In fact, to be honest, it's probably one of the hottest topics on my forum. For over 60 years, many of the engineers who fought as infantry have been trying to get their CIBs. Some have them, like my dad. Most don't. In fact, many of my veterans have written to their congressmen and senators and directly to the Army. They keep asking for a turnover, and they keep getting turned down. It's been a real fight.
Why would they be turned down for requests like that? Is it political?
Yeah, I don't think so much political as the Army's kind of reluctant to change the way things are done. Trying to briefly synopsize this. It states that you cannot have a CIB unless you fought as infantry and were in, you know, direct conflict. However, my engineers have fought directly as infantry. In fact, if you look at written assignments, it says this unit is being put into play as infantry and will fight along with such and such units. they were at the front lines during the Battle of the Bulge and during at Anzio. They were told to go to the front lines, pick up their rifles, and fought along units such as the 36th Infantry Division, the 3rd Infantry Division. Mm-hmm. So when they weren't given the chance to get their CIBs, as you can imagine, a lot of them were very upset. Some are of the opinion that, you know, they don't deserve it because they're not directly an infantry unit. And some say, well, what are we going to do, give them to cooks, you know, give them to people that are, you know, back 5 miles on the line? No,
well,
I don't think so.
Well, just their job description puts them in harm's way.
Absolutely, Mary Beth. And like I said, this, you know, I could go on about an hour on this at least, but, you know, I don't know how and when my dad earned it. To be honest, I guess I will never really know all the facts behind it. But my good friend, Captain John Fallon, who is a 36th combat engineer, he also has one. But some of the men who fought right alongside him don't. So, you know, it's a touchy subject,
yeah,
and one that I don't really know if it'll ever be resolved.
Well, that's too bad, because these men are what keep our channels and our lines open. Those awards should be handed readily to the men, these men in the engineer combat units. Tell us, Marianne, about some of the letters that you receive from people.
Oh my gosh. I get letters every day, every week. I get hundreds of letters, and they serve so much as my continued inspiration. I get letters from veterans, you know, thanking me for all I've done for them, or putting them in touch with old buddies that maybe they haven't seen for 30, 40, 50, or 60 years. Sometimes you read the letters and you just want to cry. They're so touching. One particular letter, I'm getting all choked up, sorry. One particular letter I got from my friend Bill, and he's a veteran, and just one little paragraph that he wrote to me. He said, "This will be lengthy as I'm bearing my soul. First, thank you for the entries you have made on the net. I've always felt that when I was gone, all would be forgotten, but now it is all there for the world to see. Again, thank you. Mm-hmm. You know, and when you get letters like that, it's just like, what can you say?
Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, we're at a point where our World War II veterans are dying. I mean, there aren't that many of them left. And this needs to be, this war, every part of it, every aspect of it needs to be remembered and honored. Can you talk about the importance of the preservation and the remembrance of World War II for us?
I totally agree with you that, you know, it's something that I can't emphasize enough, you know, especially now that I call them my boys. They're, you know, all well into their 80s and 90s, and it's so important to keep their stories alive for, you know, subsequent generations. I feel my role in all this is just acting as a conduit. They tell me their stories, I pass them along, and I try so hard to educate as, you know, many people as I can. I say, you know, history doesn't have to be boring, and I think I have proved that through my website and my documentary, No Bridge Too Far. I have young kids, you know, they'll come up to me and say, "Wow, we didn't know that. We didn't know this." I think it's sad. World War II, it affected the entire world. It changed so many lives, took so many lives. In kind of closing, I have a good friend, General Russ Weisskircher, and he fought with the 45th Infantry Division. Even into his 90s, he's co-chairman of the Georgia Holocaust Commission. He goes out to schools, and he reaches out to the kids. He does marvelous work. And if we could end on this, I'd like to say, as you know, the old saying goes, those who forget history are doomed to repeat it.
Absolutely. That is so true. You know, the connection that you have to this website that you started obviously is from your father. I mean, losing your dad at such a tender young age of 12 and a half years old, This was, and you used to sit by the TV and watch war movies with your dad. And
absolutely.
Listen to his stories in awe. So this box of chocolates that you had was a very strong connection. Tell us what this has done for you to keep this site, to start this site and keep it going. Not only, I mean, you started it for your father in remembrance of your father and honoring him. But where has that taken you? Where has this journey taken you?
You know, it's been, and I'm not saying this lightly, it has been a life-changing event for me. Through this, I have met literally hundreds and thousands of people from all over the world. I have so many new friends. People have come to me, like they're almost like their last dying wish, like, you know, don't let this be forgotten. It has changed my life in every aspect. It's made it richer, more fulfilling, and it's filled that void that I always had, you know, growing up without a father.
Absolutely. I can only imagine
it's been an astounding trip, and it still is. Every day I think when nothing can, you know, surprise me or nothing can make me even more happier, I'll get another phone call or another letter from a veteran or from, a family member going, God, please help me. I want to know about my dad. He passed away 2 days ago. What can you tell me? What did he do? And I have such a fulfilling life doing this. If I never did anything else again, and just did this for the rest of my life, I would die a very happy woman.
So if you don't have information on someone, do you start to dig and you help them gain the information that they need?
Absolutely. When I started all this, look how many people helped me out. I went to the Army Corps of Engineers and the Office of History, and people like Michael Broadhead helped me, sent me information. Mm-hmm. I have gleaned information from so many sources and so many people, and now I feel it's my turn to turn around and do the same for those people. I put myself in their shoes, and I tell them, you know, Don't despair. You know, I may not be able to help you with everything you want to know, but I'm going to try my best to piece all the, you know, the puzzles and put it all back together for you. So it feels good now that I like to turn around and give back to people, and hopefully I can do for them what everyone's done for me.
Absolutely, and I believe that you have, and you are, Marianne. Your site is absolutely incredible. It's been a wonderful interview, and I thank you for being a guest on my show today. I have a feeling that your dad is smiling down at you from heaven.
Oh, thank you, Mary Beth.
Thank you so much. It's been a lovely interview. Take care.
Thank you.